This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president says Tehran is not delighted with Joe Biden's victory in the U.S. presidential election, but it's happy that Donald Trump is leaving office, calling him a terrorist. The United States sets a new daily record of coronavirus cases, registering more than 248,000 infections. And South Korea reports a record daily rise in its coronavirus cases, prompting the government to issue an urgent call for more hospital beds to cope with the pandemic. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president Hassan Rouhani says he's not delighted at Joe Biden's victory in the U.S. presidential election, but is happy about the departure of President Donald Trump.
Some people say you are rejoiced at the election of Mr. Biden. No, we are not, but we are very happy that Trump is leaving. A man who committed so many crimes, who was a murderer, a terrorist, a man who even is preventing us from buying coronavirus vaccines. This man has absolutely no morals. Yes, we are very happy that this tyrant, the one who was not committed to anything, is ousted.
Rouhani described Trump as an outlaw and the most law-breaking person who became the president of the U.S. Trump walked out of a nuclear deal between Iran and world powers in 2018. He subsequently unleashed what he called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Biden has signaled his willingness to rejoin the nuclear agreement. Rouhani said Iran is ready to resume the full implementation of the 2015 pact if other parties live up to their commitments. Under the deal, Iran agreed to curb its nuclear program in return for the lifting of sanctions. Professor of International Political Economy and Senior Geopolitical Analyst Alexander Ozadegan joins us now from Irvine, California. Sir, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the recent comments made by the Iranian president.
It's good to be with you, Bardi, and it's good to be with our global audience. Well, I mean, there are two ways to be fooled. One is to believe what isn't true, and the other one is to refuse what is true. I don't think the Iranians are going to go for either of that. Washington's, and this goes beyond President Trump, you stated, you were quoting President Rouhani. It's always interesting to listen to him. My colleagues and I are kind of wary when it comes to people who speak from two sides of their mouth. But Washington's campaign of maximum pressure has really morphed into, you know, maximum delusion. There will be no negotiations needed to restore the Iranian nuclear deal. Washington, under whatever president, can just come in and go into international treaties and expect the world to hold its breath. Negotiations were over in July of 2015. Iran should not negotiate. Iran should not rely on the European powers, the E3, UK, France, and Germany. And, when you have maximum tyranny, when tyranny becomes a law, as it had become under President Trump and his mafia diplomacy, then resistance becomes a duty. And I don't think it's just Iran that's resisting Trump and Biden and the presidents to come, but several other countries that are trying to topple and do regime change and all sorts of maladies. I think John Brennan, Bardia, said something very interesting. This is the former director of the CIA. He said Trump will leave his faith to our judicial system, his infamy to history, and his legacy to a trash heap. Now, the part about the judicial system is of tremendous interest to me, because he's talking about coming back in 2024, which is not going to happen. You're going to have another crazy Zionist like Mike Pompeo running most likely against Kamala Harris. But to be fair, you know, generally speaking, reformers, and I'm talking about the Iranian reformers, the Iranian liberals, reformers in any society face a huge disadvantage because the changes they propose often take a while to impact those who will benefit from it, while the negative effects of reforms are felt immediately. The negative effects of JCPOA were felt immediately, and by that I mean the past 8 years. You're looking at Iran's currency losing, being worth one-tenth of its value during the past 7 years. It went from 3,000 toman, the unofficial Iranian currency, to almost 30,000 toman. And so this maximum pressure is hurting. People are starving. People are hurting big time. The idea of sanctions is to implement a social Darwinism, a dog-eat-dog kind of mentality that will have intergenerational implications to break the pride of one of the most civilized people on Earth with a history of 7,000 years of civilization. So that's what they intend. And I really don't see much difference with Biden in a sense that he will be a whole lot more subtle and shrewd than Trump was. For starters, he will make some symbolic acts like lift the sanctions against the IRGC, lift the sanctions against the Iranian leader, quite possibly Dr. Zarif and other high echelon generals at IRGC. But we are looking also, we have to take in internal Iranian politics in the sense that next year our forecasts are that the conservative will take over the presidency. Quite possibly General Dehghan of IRGC or former mayor of Tehran, Mr. Ghalibaf, who is due for a state visit to Russia soon.
Thank you very much, Professor Alexander Azadegan. Thank you for contributing to this segment of the program. Elsewhere, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations has called for an end to development and testing of nuclear weapons. Qasem Gharibabadi said Iran regards such a move as the first step toward total nuclear disarmament. He criticized Washington's approach on the non-proliferation regime, expressing concern over the possibility of the U.S. conducting nuclear test explosions. Iran's envoy said a possible resumption of the tests will not only breach a treaty on the moratorium on the practices, but also violates the nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation efforts. Elsewhere in his remarks, Gharibabadi mentioned Saudi Arabia's nuclear program, calling on the country to join the NPT. He made the remarks at the 55th meeting of the Preparatory Commission of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization has opposed a new United Nations treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. NATO says the treaty is at odds with the existing non-proliferation and disarmament architecture of the alliance. In its statement, the organization added that the treaty lacks any rigorous or clear mechanism for verification, has not been signed by any nuclear-armed state, and thus will not result in the elimination of a single nuclear weapon. The Treaty of the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was approved by over 120 countries in 2017 and enters into force on January 21st, 2021. Countries that have ratified the ban are prohibited from developing and testing nukes. Political commentator George Samueli says NATO has been committed to the use of nuclear weapons for decades and has been causing wars and instability in the world.
They're obviously going to oppose it because NATO has for decades, from very early on, been committed to the use of nuclear weapons, not just to the use of nuclear weapons, but even to the first use of nuclear weapons. The military doctrine to which NATO was committed during the Cold War was that the only way that NATO could cope with Russian superiority in conventional arms was that they would resort to nuclear weapons. And so every time the USSR proposed coming to some kind of a no first use of nuclear weapons agreement, it was always rejected by NATO. And when we talk about NATO, we largely talk about the United States, because the United States is the dominant force in NATO. Now, I actually don't think the nuclear weapons issue is really the main problem with NATO. I mean, NATO has many, many other problems. It's been causing wars and instability ever since the Cold War came to an end.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump refuses to concede the 2020 election to his Democratic rival Joe Biden, despite several Republicans accepting their party's defeat.
The president is still involved in ongoing litigation related to the election. The campaign would have more specifics for you on legal recourse, but yesterday was one step in the constitutional process leading up to the January 20th date in the Constitution.
The comments by the White House press secretary follow a Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's acknowledgement of Joe Biden's victory. McConnell said the Electoral College vote has removed any doubt that Biden would be the next president. He added, however, that he had hoped for a, quote, different result. On Monday, electors met and officially affirmed Biden's election win. In the next step, Congress should certify the electoral count on January the 6th. Rami Mazari, our correspondent in Chicago, says U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has acknowledged Biden's victory because he sees little chance for President Trump and Republicans to be able to overturn the results of the November election.
You know, he's conceding because there's really not any way to reverse the results, you know, now. The next step is on January 6th, Congress counts the votes, and they can debate the votes, but because the Democrats control the House of Representatives, the House votes on any sort of debates. So it seems like it's really sort of a foregone conclusion, and that explains why McConnell has conceded. However, you know, between now and December 6th, this country is still going to be filled with claims of voter fraud. You know, you have 1,000 sworn affidavits of irregularities. But voter fraud is a huge burden of proof on the accuser. And then they also have to prove enough voter fraud to swing the election. So that's even more proof.
The United States has set a new daily record of coronavirus infections with more than 248,000 new cases in 24 hours. The figure was registered by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday. Total confirmed COVID cases in the U.S. topped 16.7 million. Its death toll is above 300,000. Infections have increased dramatically there over the past month. The pandemic has taken a heavy toll on U.S. economy as well. Congress leaders have held a second meeting to end a months-long standoff on a new virus relief package. They cited progress in the talks. Congress approved $3 trillion in aid in spring. Since then, lawmakers have argued about whether more is needed. South Korea has reported its highest daily number of coronavirus infections since the pandemic began. The country on Tuesday registered 1,078 new cases in 24 hours. That brings the overall infections in South Korea to more than 45,000. The country also reported a dozen new fatalities Tuesday. That marks the second day of double-digit deaths after a record 13 the day before. Total COVID deaths in South Korea are now above 600. The virus surge has prompted the government to issue an urgent call for more hospital beds. Cases have spiked despite the tightening of social distancing rules last week. As Jennifer Chang in Seoul says, South Korea is trying to enforce current social distancing rules to avoid a possible national lockdown.
Health authorities really looking at raising social distancing to level 3 possibly, but if they can help it, they don't want to do that. That's the maximum level. And that is a lockdown as far as South Korea is concerned. It's not as severe as many of the lockdowns we've seen in Europe, but they would not be allowing any gatherings of 10 or more people. Schools would be closed to in-person classes. All classes would be conducted online. And they would also ban non-essential workers from coming into work. They would have to work from home. So this will deal a huge blow to self-employed people and small businesses. And the government is already reeling. So if they can help it, they'd like to step up their digital contact tracing of people who might be carrying COVID-19, especially asymptomatic patients. This disease has an incubation period of 2 weeks during which symptoms may not show up very well or not show up at all.
European countries struggle with the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic as daily infections and deaths rapidly rise. Germany on Tuesday reported its highest number of deaths in a single day with 952 new fatalities. That brings the country's overall death toll to over 23,000. Germany also registered more than 27,000 new cases, taking its total to over 1.3 million. The virus surge has prompted the country to tighten a lockdown set to be implemented from Wednesday. Several other European countries have also tightened restrictions ahead of the upcoming holiday season. In Britain, the capital, London, is moving into its highest tier of coronavirus restrictions. Petrol stations in Italy have begun a three-day strike, calling on the government to include all station management firms in new COVID support measures. Max Chivili has more in this report.
Italy's petrol station operators have been staging a strike since Monday to demand the Italian government being included among the recipients of support measures to mitigate the nefarious impact of the anti-COVID restrictions. It is the latest in a string of petrol station strikes over market conditions and aid measures during the pandemic emergency. In late November, another three-day strike had been called by sector unions and organizations and staged on the country's motorways.
Petrol retailers' associations complained that gas stations suffered losses amounting to 90% of their revenues on Italy's motorways and about 60% of their income in urban areas during the lockdown. They say it is no longer possible to meet overheads and fixed costs in the current situation.
Small and very small petrol station operators have been excluded from receiving aid payments from the government because all petrol stations remained open during the lockdown. Considering the cancellation of sales due to COVID and restrictions, we are at risk of no longer being able to guarantee the opening of stations with continuity and regularity.
Last month, the Italian government issued a package of aid for the businesses and families most affected by the new anti-COVID restrictions. As many as 211,000 companies have received support funds totaling over 960 million euros.
There's no doubt that support measures to businesses and families have helped a bit. Having said that, the situation remains critical for many, unfortunately.
New talks between the government and retail groups are likely to be held in the coming days. Petrol station operators are slated to end the strike on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
EU lawmakers say the 27-nation bloc sovereignty is under attack due to U.S. trade-related sanctions. The legislators say EU firms are unfairly being prevented from engaging in legitimate business with countries like Iran, Russia, and Cuba. Jerome Hughes reports.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that the EU is far too dependent on the United States dollar, and there is a serious lack of political will when it comes to negating the effects of U.S. sanctions.
The recent American economic sanctions against Russia, Iran, and Cuba, especially the extraterritorial effects, should be responded from our side. We need an efficient instrument to counteract these illegal sanctions.
Big firms such as Airbus, Peugeot, and Citroen want to do business with countries like Iran, but are being told by the Trump administration that if they do, they will not be able to trade with the United States.
In relation to Iran, the Commission is supportive of the instrument in support of trade exchanges, INSTEX, an initiative of three countries initially, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, and more recently joined by Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland, and Sweden.
However, many lawmakers say that EU instruments designed to bypass US sanctions, such as the aforementioned INSTEX, and also the so-called blocking statute, are dysfunctional.
Some analysts argue that European Union foreign policy has been very negatively influenced in recent years by Washington, and that ultimately it is ordinary, hard-working EU citizens who are paying the price for that.
This is because millions of additional jobs could be created if the EU more effectively counteracted US sanctions. Countries like Iran, Russia, and Cuba represent huge markets.
It does not only affect EU businesses, but also puts into question the political independence and ultimately the sovereignty of the EU and its member states.
Apparently, hypocrisy is rife. For example, the EU and US shy away from imposing sanctions on Israel and Saudi Arabia, despite the atrocities these regimes commit against civilians in Palestine and Yemen. EU lawmakers have expressed hope that the Joe Biden administration will be less aggressive with respect to sanctions. However, they are calling on the EU to quickly develop policies to try and deliver strategic autonomy for the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers have realized a person's brain scan results can differ from day to day, even under identical conditions, casting a doubt on how to document consistent patterns. With so many questions being raised, some researchers are acknowledging the scan's limitations and working to overcome them, or simply turning to other tests. Earlier this year, Duke University researcher Anchen Kenote Lab published the latest paper challenging the reliability of common brain scan projects based on about 60 studies of the past decade, including her own. Kenote said, "We found this poor result across the board," adding, "We're basically discrediting much of the work we've done. The research being re-examined relies on a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. Using large magnets, the scans detect where oxygenated blood rushes to when someone does an activity, such as memorizing a list of words or touching fingertips together, allowing scientists to indirectly measure brain activity. When the technology debuted in the early 1990s, it opened a seemingly revolutionary window into the human brain. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Marion Reynolds titled, Why Are Some Scientists Turning Away from Brain Scans? This article has appeared on the front page of the Associated Press News Agency's website. Please stay with us to hear more about Marion Reynolds article. Brain scans offer a tantalizing glimpse into the mind's mysteries, promising an almost X-ray-like vision into how we feel pain, interpret faces, and wiggle fingers. Studies of brain images have suggested that Republicans and Democrats have visibly different thinking, that overweight adults have stronger responses to pictures of food, and that's possible to predict a sober person's likelihood of relapse. But such buzzy findings are coming under growing scrutiny as scientists grapple with the fact that some brain scan research doesn't seem to hold up. Such studies have been criticized for relying on too few subjects and for incorrectly analyzing or interpreting data. Researchers have also realized that a person's brain scan results can differ from day to day, even under identical conditions, casting a doubt on how to document consistent patterns. With so many questions being raised, some researchers are acknowledging the scan's limitations and working to overcome them, or simply turning to other tests. Earlier this year, Duke University researcher Anchen Kenote Lab published the latest paper challenging the reliability of common brain scan projects, based on about 60 studies of the past decade, including her own. Kenote said, "We found this poor result across the board," adding, "We are basically discrediting much of the work we've done." The research being re-examined relies on a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. Using large magnets, the scans detect where oxygenated blood rushes to when someone does an activity, such as memorizing a list of words or touching fingerprints together, allowing scientists to indirectly measure brain activity. When the technology debuted in early 1990s, it opened a seemingly revolutionary window into the human brain. Other previous imaging techniques tracked brain activity through electrodes placed on the skull or radioactive tracers injected into the bloodstream. In comparison, fMRI seemed like a fast, high-resolution, and non-invasive alternative. A flurry of papers and press coverage followed the technique's invention, pointing to parts of the brain that light up when we fall in love, feel pain, or make difficult decisions. But as years passed, troubling evidence began to surface that challenged some of those findings. The man Stanley, a brain scientist at Adelphi University, said, "It's a very powerful thing to show a picture of the brain. It lends itself to abuse in some ways," adding, "People eat them up. Things get overblown. Somewhere in there, we lost the nuance." In 2009, a group of scientists investigated papers that had linked individual differences in brain activity to various personality types. They found many used a type of analysis that reported only the strongest correlations, leading to potentially coincidental conclusions. The group wrote, "A disturbingly large amount of fMRI research on emotion and personality relied on these seriously defective research methods." Later that year, another pair of researchers demonstrated that the raw results of imaging scans without the proper statistical corrections could detect brain activity in a dead Atlantic salmon. 4 years ago, another group of scientists claimed a different common statistical error had led thousands of fMRI projects astray. This year, Stanford University researchers described what happened when they gave the same fMRI data to 70 groups of independent neuroscientists. No two teams used the same analysis methods, and overall, the researchers did not always come to the same conclusions about what the data demonstrated about brain activity. Duke neuroscientist Anita Disney said, "In the end, we probably jumped on fMRI bandwagon a little too fast. It's reached the threshold of concern for a lot of us. With doubts growing, many labs have become more cautious about what imaging techniques to use in efforts to unravel the average brain's 110,000 miles. That is about 177,000 kilometers of nerve fibers. For example, Yale University researcher Joy Hirsch wants to understand the social brain. What happens when people talk, touch, or make eye contact? She's opted out of fMRI since it can only be used on a single person who must remain perfectly still for imaging inside a large scanner. Instead, Hirsch uses an alternative technology that bounces laser lights off a fiber optic cable laced skull cap into the brain to detect blood flow. The technique, functional near-infrared spectroscopy, allows her subject to move freely during scanning and permits her to study live social interactions between several people." Duke neuroscientist Anita Disney also shies away from fMRI, which she says is too crude of an instrument for her forays into the molecular relationship between brain chemistry, behavior, and states like attentiveness. That doesn't mean everyone is walking away from fMRI. Some surgeons depend on the technique to map a patient's brain before surgeries, and the technology has proven itself useful for broadly mapping the neural mechanisms of diseases such as schizophrenia or Alzheimer's. Today, optogenetics, an emerging technique that uses light to activate neurons, is poised to be brain science's next siren technology. Some say it's too early to know whether they will adopt it as a tool. Stanford brain scientist Ross Polkrak said the evolving understanding of fMRI and its limits shows science at work and should ultimately make people more confident in the results, not less. Paul Crack said, "We want to show people you have to pay attention to this stuff," adding, "Otherwise, people are going to lose faith in our ability to answer questions."
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najjar. Illegal settlement activity in full swing. Tel Aviv intends to build 8,300 more settler units in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. The Israeli regime has pressed ahead with the activity in defiance of international law. This has ended up in the forced eviction of Palestinians from their homes. Recently, an Israeli court has given the Palestinians in an area, East Jerusalem Al-Quds, 30 days to leave their homes. And this while a few Arab states have claimed so-called Washington broker normalization deals with Israel, yet the settlements are growing despite Tel Aviv's promise to suspend them in exchange for those agreements. Now let's go to Ramallah and ask Mona Kandil for an update on the latest illegal Israeli settlement expansion. Mona.
Israeli media on Wednesday revealed that the Israeli authorities approved the building of 8,300 settler units in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, with the confiscation of lands from the villages of Beit Safafa, Malha, and Baqa, all the way to Al-Walaji village, northwest Beit Lahm, in the occupied West Bank. According to the reports, the construction will be for residential, commercial, and industrial purposes. The Palestinian Authority slammed the Israeli plan and says it's a green light from the Israeli authorities to continue confiscation of lands and impose more facts on ground. It seems that the Israeli regime is racing against time in order to impose more facts on ground, in order to confiscate more lands and expand the illegal settlements before the outgoing U.S. administration leaves office, because they know that the current American administration has given the green light for the Israeli authorities to continue expanding the settlements. At the same time, the Israeli authorities also approved the building and the construction of roads between the settlements and the occupied West Bank in order to link the settlements together. And this is also the main aim of these roads, is to facilitate the confiscation of the lands. There were reports recently from the Israeli authorities saying that the Israeli regime is working to make the number of the Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank to reach 1 million. Today we are speaking about 500,000 of settlers in the occupied West Bank and 250 settlers living in the illegal settlements in Jerusalem Al-Quds.
Okay, thank you for that. That was Mona Kandil with an update from Ramallah. Now, joining me in this show tonight will be from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, Ken Stone, out of Hamilton, Ontario, and also National Co-Director of the Code Pink, Ariel Gold, who is joining us out of New York. Good to have both of you on the show. Let's go to Ken. Tel Aviv this year has had a target of building 3,000 settlement homes in the West Bank and making 2020 one of the most prolific years for illegal settlement activity. Now, settlement watchdog group Peace Now says that this is by far the highest number of approvals since Trump took office, and also the highest since Peace Now started watching those figures in 2012. What's your assessment?
Well, I'd like to preface my remarks by, first of all, wishing Ms. Goldberg and all the Jewish viewers of Press TV a happy Hanukkah, and point out that an ever-increasing number of Jews in North America do not support the Zionist colonial project, and in fact participate in BDS and other initiatives to support the Palestinian people. So, to your question about the settlements, these settlements are flagrantly illegal. They are violations of international law, and they are in violation of numerous UN resolutions which call for them to be dismantled, taken away, and the land turned over, the occupation ended, and the land turned over to the Palestinian people to be part of a Palestinian, independent Palestinian state. Now, why so many more settlements this year and in the last few years? It's clearly because the Israeli government has gotten the green light from a president who's probably the most friendly president to Israel that we have ever seen. And the green light came in the form of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, for endorsing the plan to annex most of the West Bank outright, and the plan to annex the Golan Heights, which are part of the sovereign state of Syria. So having this president in place and the green light of all these three measures which I just mentioned has given the Israeli government the confidence and also the money and the backing and security to go ahead with an increased, completely illegal settlement program.
Now let's turn to New York. Ariel, Tel Aviv had promised to put on hold the plans to annex parts of the West Bank in return for Washington brokered normalization deals with Arab states. And you know the deals were signed in return for prizes from Washington, but settlement expansion has not stopped. It's even accelerated. Why is that?
What a farce that these normalization deals had anything to do with peace or with stopping annexation. We know what was given to the Arab states in return for normalizing apartheid, because that's what was normalized, apartheid and occupation. The UAE is set to receive a massive weapons deal, including the coveted, deadly F-35 fighter jet. And now with Morocco having normalized relations with Israel, the Morocco is in exchange receiving recognition from the United States for its illegal occupation of Western Sahara, as well as a $1 billion weapons deal. So these normalization deals have nothing to do with peace at all, and they have nothing to do with stopping annexation. That was a complete farce. This is about normalizing the violence, normalizing apartheid, normalizing occupation, and normalizing the influx of weapons into the Middle East.
Can you remember Tel Aviv had promised that this is what it will do? It will put on hold, at least, or postpone the settlement expansion. But you see, the reverse is happening. You know, every day there is ratification on top of ratification, expanding more and more settlements.
Oh, I couldn't agree with Ms. Gold more. In fact, there is a further element that could be mentioned here. The the trade minister of Bahrain recently said that Bahrain would accept all kinds of Israeli goods, even goods from the illegal settlements, to be shipped into Bahrain, and then, of course, Bahrain would become the gateway for these products to go in, be distributed throughout the Arab world. The UAE did almost the same thing. They have already accepted wines that are produced in Israel from grapes grown in the Golan Heights, which belongs to Syria, and those are already for sale in the UAE, and a delegation of settler colonists from the illegally occupied West Bank of Palestine went to Dubai, which is part of the UAE, and they struck a deal with the UAE to ship out their products of their illegal settlements. So these countries that said, oh, we're going to stop the annexation of the West Bank, they are actually becoming business partners of the illegal settlements. That's how much of a sham it is.
Mm-hmm. unfortunately. Now, Ariel, Palestinians want the entire West Bank as part of their future independent state, and they're complaining that this growing illegal settlement expansion has made it increasingly difficult for them to achieve their dream of independence. So what will become of an independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital, given the circumstances?
I think that the whole world has to accept that the two-state solution is so long past dead. How many funerals can we have for what is now an unachievable situation? It is already one singular state between the river and the sea, but it is one apartheid state. And this has now become a rights-based struggle where we have to support Palestinians to achieve their basic human rights, including the right to vote, including the right to not live under the military regime, their rights to equality, and so much more. This is now a rights-based situation from a long time ago. And it's really Israel that both caused this and now in many ways is going to have to deal with the ramifications of that, because it is Israel that is obsessed with maintaining a demographic majority, which cannot be maintained if full rights and equality are secured for all people.
Mm-hmm. Ken, do you also believe that a two-state solution is dead? What is the solution?
Oh, the solution is clear. It's a Palestinian state in all of occupied Palestine, in all of historic Palestine. Mm-hmm. And that's the position that the Iranian government has taken, and that's the position that many Palestinians have taken. Now, as Ms. Gold has pointed out, right now Israel is, and it's the occupied territories, is part of one unified apartheid regime. And the struggle now has to be against apartheid and against that regime, which has justified itself by a horrible law called the National Law, I believe, which states that the Israeli government is a government that is in favor of a Jewish state, and which will benefit its Jewish citizens only at the expense of all of its other citizens. So people around the world should take note and say, just in the way, as in the way we boycotted and we tried to divest pension funds and we sanctioned the former apartheid state of South Africa and helped to achieve majority government there. So we need to work with the Palestinian people who have called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and sanction, boycott, and call for divestment of pension plans in the rest of the world that are invested in the state of Israel to bring about, bring down the apartheid regime and create a one state where Jews and Arabs can live together in peace and all the Palestinian refugees can return.
Okay. Now, Ariel, all the U.S. administrations and the international community have opposed Tel Aviv settlement construction that's deemed to be illegal under international law. Donald Trump is the only U.S. president who adopted a different approach and defied his predecessors. What made him act that way?
Well, I might have to challenge that idea that Donald Trump was the only U.S. president that adopted that. Other U.S. presidents did so by non-action. So other U.S. presidents, while condemning settlement growth or asking Israel not to expand settlement, did not actually put any teeth behind that, which is in itself an implicit approval. And Israel knew very much that there were no consequences, that there were no conditions upon which it really must behave. So what Donald Trump did is he actually did this in the full daylight, and it has been grotesque and horrifying to watch, but it isn't really too out of line with previous U.S. presidents. We saw President Obama condemn settlements. We even saw him let a U.N. resolution go through at the end of his term, yet also at the end of his term, he increased U.S. military aid to Israel. So as far as Israel is seeing, they are getting this U.S. military aid, and they see that as a green light because, in fact, it is a green light.
Yeah, and Ken, we see that the Trump administration is also trying its best in the last days there at the Oval Office. You know, a while ago, we had Secretary of State paying a visit there, and he was the first to visit the Golan Heights, you know, there, and they're called Trump Heights. And also, in broad daylight, they simply, he went as far as saying that the settlement activity is not illegal.
Well, if you want my take on it, the U.S. government has, as Ms. Gold has pointed out, always supported the state of Israel. It's enabled it, and so has the Canadian government. The Canadian government allows the settlement goods to be sold in Canada as, quote, products of Israel. There's a big case that independent Jewish voices and others in Canada have been fighting about that. And the Canadian government allows charitable status to the Jewish National Fund, which raises money to build the settlements in the occupied West Bank and in the Golan Heights as well. So these are the Western governments are the enablers of this occupation. And I was watching the U.S. Election pretty carefully, and I did not see that Mr. Biden said that he would do anything differently. He did not say he would move the embassy back to Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. He did not say he would rescind the endorsement of the annexation of the West Bank. He did not say that he would rescind the endorsement of the Golan Heights. And none of the liberals in the U.S. Who complain so bitterly about these things even asked him to do it. So, frankly, I don't think the policy is going to even change with the new administration mm-hmm. on January the 20th.
Yeah, what Ariel, what Ken just mentioned brings me to my next question regarding a new president at the Oval Office. Do you expect any changes as regards settlement activity in the Palestinian cause?
Unfortunately, we do not expect much. We are seeing great changes, though, in Congress and in American opinion and in American Jewish opinion. And so we know where our strengths are, and we know very much where we need to do our work.
Mm-hmm, I see. So, Ken, don't you see any light at the end of the tunnel for the Palestinians during the, let's say, Biden presidency?
The only light I see at the end of the tunnel for the Palestinian cause is if the Palestinian leadership stops relying on the leaders of those Arab states which are clients of the U.S. empire, which are already in the pocket of the U.S. government. I think that the Palestinian movement should follow the example of the resistance front, that is to say, the governments of Iran, Syria, and of Hezbollah in Lebanon. They have shown the way to resist successfully the Israeli occupation and annexation plan. And I think that the way forward for liberation for the Palestinian people is the path of resistance.
And Ariel, what kind of a prospect can you imagine for Tel Aviv's annexation plans in future? Is there anything that can put a halt to this illegal move?
Well, I have to disagree with my colleague in terms of looking to places like Syria, where there are gross human rights abuses as well. I think this is about building global solidarity and about coming together through nonviolent struggle and continuing the work that we're doing, where we are seeing successes, like in shifting U.S. Congress and in shifting opinion. And we have to support the Palestinian nonviolent struggle on the ground.
Mm-hmm. What about my question? How far will this annexation plan and settlement activity go on?
Well, it looks like it's going to go on quite quickly and quite extensively. We've seen that for many, many decades now, which has brought it to the one-state reality that it is.
Mm-hmm. So, Ken, what is it that can stop this illegal push, the settlement activity? Is it only Palestinian unity and United States?
Well, as I said before, stop relying on the Arab leaders already in the pockets of the U.S. empire, mm-hmm. and follow the example of the resistance front. But I agree with Ms. Gold that It requires solidarity from people who believe in freedom and self-determination around the world. And it means that people in the West especially should be organizing to pressure their governments to stop enabling this Zionist occupation by removing the support for Israel at the United Nations, and by stopping the funding to Israel and stopping the fundraising for Israel within their jurisdictions.
All right, on that note, we come to the end of this debate. Let me thank my guests from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. We had Ken Stone from Hamilton, Ontario, and also National Co-Director of the Code Pink, Ariel Gould, who joined us out of New York.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. The term Ul al-Albab in Ayah 190 of Surah Al-Imran means those who possess intellects. Now, the concept of possessing intellect does not mean simple understanding of the signs of Allah. This means that intellect possessors contemplate on the creation of Allah. Now, there are some people who have knowledge about the solar system and understand the order that exists on the Earth and other planets. However, they do not contemplate on that and have a scientific look at it merely without connecting it to a higher almighty power. Such people are not considered intellect possessors according to the Quran. Ul al-Albab are those who can connect all these orderly manners to Allah. In other words, the real lob or wisdom is for those who think about the higher power who created this. If people leave their biases, disagreements, ignorance, and enmities, then they will be able to find out the true source behind all the creations on the galaxy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khala Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khala Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52-48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. After it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday, the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because, you know, it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.